Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? And tonight we're going to be hearing part two of my conversation with Gordon White. And of course, Michael Hughes has helped me out with this. I do want to apologize for last week's interview with Gordon. You undoubtedly noticed me coughing through parts of that interview. Well, here's the thing. The recording software I use, Pamela, used to, when I muted Skype, it would mute it on the recording. Well, apparently that has changed. So I muted my Skype every time I coughed, which is why no one reacted to me coughing. But I didn't realize that it had made it onto the recording until after everything was edited together and up. And I was absolutely horrified to hear me coughing because I wasn't exactly holding back because I thought I was muted and I was trying to clear my throat and, make sure I wasn't going to cough while I was talking. So I apologize greatly for that. I now know that it doesn't mute it. So I was able to fix it on this part. And the roundtable we did as well, I was able to go in and take out any coughing that may have occurred that I had thought was muted. Yeah. So I apologize again. I'm sure that was very annoying and it annoyed the hell out of me. All right. I got some cool stuff coming up for Patreons. If you want to help out the show, it's only $3 a month to become a Patreon. We're going to have the Q&A from the Travis premiere that happened after they premiered it at the State Theater here in Ithaca. And also, I'm going to be putting up for everyone an interview with Travis Walton and the producer of the movie. And another interview I filmed while I was there. So those will be going up on the YouTube because they were video interviews. And I guess that's about it for right now. Here we go with part two of my talk with Gordon White.
One of the things that has come up in your books, kind of in passing, but is such a major theme on this show, is that of the UFO phenomena. What are your thoughts of what we see there?
Lots of things. It's an interesting mirror and an interesting discourse, I guess. I think if we're talking about in the 20th century and to some extent the 21st century, we are we're looking at things that we're not supposed to know exist. As simple as that, and that's physics. That's experiments on children, that mass experiments of hallucinogens and truth sera on unsuspecting innocent populations, that's the testing of new aircraft. That's kind of it. It's been a very good umbrella term for a lot of nefarious things that Anglo-Americans have been up to during the Cold War. So I think in a lot of sense, in many respects, that's in there. And in large part, the kind of what people who aren't interested in UFOs think ufology is essentially the smokescreen covering that. And within it, something more interesting has gone on. And funnily enough, I think something more interesting went on as a result of doing these behind the curtain experiments that made the people who were performing them realize they're in a much bigger world than they are. So that's ufology. If you're doing it on a volume basis, that's ufology. If you're not doing it on a volume basis, if you're actually saying, yes, okay, put that aside, I think it is a way of describing most of the stuff we've been talking about on the show. So non-human entities and human psi capacities or even meaning of life in the universe. I think it's a way of thinking about and describing that is in some senses useful and in some senses not, because within ufology you have to have an understanding of, well, you need to build your own models of what kind of physics is going on and who else is in the universe and what's the point of life and where did Earth come from and all that kind of stuff. So ufology is in the right hands, ufology is quite a good philosophy. In the wrong hands, which it more often is, it's not. And that largely is it for me, I think.
You wrote, I think it may have even been today, a recent blog post about the whole physical alien question. And that's something that, you know, for much of what we talk about on this show is the non-materialist idea of these entities. But clearly there's a lot of evidence that there's something very physical involved. And you know, there are anomalies on other planets that we've seen. So it's, you know, I try not to, for a long time, I fell very far into the, you know, the ultra terrestrial sort of camp. But I find myself over time being pulled back in the direction of the idea of, you know, physical aliens. Mm. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So everything, the conservative turn, I can't remember it was in this recording, but the conservative turn that has happened in culture and is thus happening in magic, which is the kind of assigning status to historical accuracy, is a pendulum. So and it's swung and it's probably peaking now. That sort of lionization of historical accuracy is probably peaking now, and it was swung back the whole other way in the mid-90s. So there appears to be like a 20-year pendulum swing between iconoclasm and conservatism. Now ufology has its own one, and ufology's own one is, you know, ETH, non-ETH, swing backwards and forwards. And I think we're at peak non-ETH, or a bit past peak non-ETH, because it absolutely needed to be done. It'll need to be done again when it comes back around. but it absolutely needed to be done. The trouble is, not the trouble, ufology such as it exists in the next 10 years is going to have to incorporate, I expect, the actual public declarations of things like organisms on Mars and potentially in Antarctica and so on. So the pivot is going to need to be around modeling things that are in the literal definition of alien, things that exist as aliens. Now that doesn't mean, you know, the movie Arrival, it to start with, it'll mean, you know, fossilized goo and we'll go from there. But I think we're actually quite near that. And the necessary implications of that are, we need to start talking about, and it seems to me, how to describe this? I suspect the answer is, we were just talking about Fort's dominant of witchcraft. You live in an animist universe that also has aliens. So that's probably the best place to think from now, rather than the more totalizing that we saw maybe about 18 months ago of the over-focus on a kind of extra-dimensional hypothesis, because as I sort of said in the blog post, sometimes it's aliens. It doesn't invalidate psi effects. It doesn't invalidate life after death. It doesn't invalidate magic actually working. These things all happen in a magic universe in which aliens have probably at least once visited us. And that's kind of where, now, and it was good, like clearing out the kind of Roswell types was very useful. Very useful as the kind of extra dimensional turn of the 21st century happened. But now we need to kind of look back and go, okay, so can we talk about real aliens without getting the Roswell people back? and I don't know if we can, but I really do hope we can, because I think we're into a really robust worldview if we can have that discussion without somebody telling Stephen Greer.
See, to me, the UFO question kind of brings all this stuff together, because it has connections through so much other stuff, you know, other phenomena, altered states of consciousness. All of it seems to somehow interconnect in the UFO question.
It's the Chapel Perilous. So you can, you mentioned Skeptico. So I talked to Alex a bit, not on the show, but just in general. And there are I don't say there are an infinite number of roads. There are maybe five or six roads into the middle of Chapel Perilous. And he came down the consciousness research road, and I came down the magic road. And I know people who came down the UFO road. And kind of what I was saying before, you know you're in it when you're in Fort's Dominant of Witchcraft, and it kind of doesn't matter which of these roads you come down, because you get into the middle and all of a sudden you do have a not just a model of, but a workable model of how you think about, think with, and engage with these ideas. And this is what I mean. Ufology in the right hands is itself a legitimate and complete philosophy. It's just, it's not that often in the right hands.
Yeah,
that reminds me of the thing that blew my mind. It was one of Jeff Kripal's books. And he talks about how when he found out that Hynek and someone had inherited Hynek's, maybe it was Jacques Vallée, his book collection, and it was all Rosicrucianism and occultism and esoterica and things like that. It really does seem that, you know, you're right, that the roads that you take, whether it's, you know, cryptid studies or psi or ufology or near-death experiences, we all kind of wind up in the same, you know, the same room in the Fortean conference, you know, which I've experienced literally more so, it seems, you know, it used to be kind of a caricature that everyone was stuck in their own little specialty, their own little rut. It didn't look outside that much, but it really seems like there's a, you know, very much a transdisciplinary new sort of outlook among people in the anomalous. And I guess that's also encouraged by, you know, how academia is opening up a little bit, as we see with Dr. Kripal and others.
Yeah, and that's kind of where, if anything, because I agree 1,000,000%, if anything, that's what triggered yesterday's post about sometimes it's actual aliens. Because the thing, it used to be maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the cliched ufology discussion was non-ETH people whining about how the only thing people talk about in ufology is ETH. But that never happened. There's in magic, there's the same idea that there's this sort of unending number of fluffy bunny Wiccans out there that everyone's railing against that don't exist. Mm-hmm. And in kind of ufology, it's a, yeah, you'll find some fringe people on the edge, but I want the discussion to update from in this kind of hypothetical multi-anomalous research conference. As long as we don't say, oh, well, those silly ETH people, like we're at a point where we need to have a discussion about what we do talk about and what we don't talk about. And I think I think that's where we're at. I think it's almost like the cliche, the imagined cliche 5 years ago was that everyone was talking about ETH. And talking about how everyone was talking about ETH is kind of like the cliche now, and it's the piece that needs to be broken down and used in sort of public engagement with other disciplines. And I think that's happening. I think that's actually what Dominant of Witchcraft looks like. I really do think it is a by necessarily implication chaotic field of or uneven data sets that require examination and almost individual modeling, but the data sets that from after death research need to be modeled in conjunction with UFO data sets and psi research and so on, because, as you know, I'm fond of saying, as McKenna said, if it's real, it can take the pressure. And I think we're there. I think we're at a point where that interdisciplinary, it's so silly calling them disciplines, but like that intertextual data analysis is what needs to be done.
Well, I think Kenneth Ring did that with the NDEs and UFO experiencers, but no one really followed up on it.
Well, now we can, you know, because he's only got 2 of the 5 that we just mentioned there. So
true.
Maybe it's like Voltron, you know, we all kind of plug in.
And if I remember right, he was pretty resistant to even looking at the UFO data until he sat down and read Communion and realized that there were connections there.
Mm. Yeah. And that, I mean, I spoke to Dr. Dean Radin recently, and his next book's going to be about magic, which he ignored for a 30-year career in parapsychology. And he's sheepish about now, but you look at it and go, well, yeah. So I think that's happening. I think that is the story of the next 2 years. At least, hopefully longer.
Now, you also talk about like the whole ancient astronaut type of thing briefly in this book. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on people like Sitchin and the idea that there could be ancient astronauts far in our past?
It depends how far back you go, because I am an interventionist. So I don't think life emerged on this planet without appearing at least at a DNA level formed from elsewhere. And that's not actually a controversial position. Even Dawkins has that position without realizing its implications. So I'm very much, at the very least, a directed panspermiest, but like on more than one level, because I don't think you can get soil formation on planet Earth without the appearance of mycelium at the same time, because bacteria doesn't evolve into mycelium and backwards, and you need both the soil formation, which you need to capture the water, which we don't know where it came from, to build the soil so that the plants could grow. So even at a later stage than initial panspermia, I think it probably happened more than once. I think it was almost like building a house, like genuinely terraforming. But that's not necessarily the Sumerian gods are aliens here to mine gold to save their atmosphere. I have a lot of, and I think we all should, have a lot of respect for Sitchin as a person, because he actually said, well, F it. I'm going to teach myself Akkadian, and I'm going to teach myself these all these different languages. And he was correct. He observed and they hadn't even really been translated 50 years or looked at by the time he did. And he says, I don't think this is correct, and I don't think they're describing what Woolley thought they were describing in the British Museum in the 1800s. And I think his thesis is correct, but no one who's first at anything is correct. And that's sort of where that's how I think of Sitchin now. His thesis isn't very good, but we should, hats off to him for attempting to make a start at it. And that is, in some respects, that means he's more right than wrong. Even though he's wrong about everything, he's more right than wrong, because the classical view of the emergence of civilization, and particularly Sumerian civilization at the time, was wrong. He's still kind of trapped in a materialist trap, and he had his own thing going on with kind of sort of trying to prove Judaism in this weird way, except Yahweh's also this Egyptian god. And like, so he had some kind of space Judaism going that respects, like, have your belief system, Sitchin. And out of that, I think, but the principal thing we need to kind of remember about Sitchin is that he looked at sort of official materialist history and said it was wrong. It's just that his version of it was materialist. I'm perfectly happy with the idea, and I think there's no other way of conceiving of the earliest Near Eastern North African civilizations like Sumer and Egypt, and even the, so if we're talking Eurasia, even the Indus Valley, I don't think there's any way of conceiving of it without having a level of extra dimensional contact that would be astounding to us today, at least publicly. We don't know what they're doing behind the curtain. And I think that's fine. Like, I know he was picking up on the right thing. It's just that he had it as nuclear powered rocket ships and all this, which is fine. Yeah, the first person is always wrong, but he's kind of like our ancestor in a way.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Starships. And, I've described that to people as sort of a Chariots of the Gods, but spirits and not physical spacemen. That was a real eye opener for me. The idea that these extra dimensional, if you want to call them that, ultra terrestrial, influences may indeed have been from space. Because they seem to be so associated with star lore, but that may have been that may have sort of formed the technological knowledge. So it really, completely upends the whole Chariots of the Gods, Sitchin, Sumerian ideas. But it kind of, it kind of says, well, they're sort of right in a way. But they were just talking physical spacemen versus some sort of spiritual contact.
It struck me as a worldview dysfunction, because if you look at how I characterize the role of stars and star spirits in starships, it doesn't depart that far from, say, what many Australian Aboriginal cultures would say, like, the stars are the spirits. They interact with us in this way. They present themselves in this way, and as a result of our interaction with them, we have these treasures and these skills and these songs, and that seems to and you look how the civilizations of which we are the children of it emerged, and they said the same thing. And the better they got, there's a technological exchange there, the more precise they got, something appears to have happened. And ancient aliens is a worldview dysfunction. It's not necessarily wrong, because I would be the last person to suggest that human history isn't filled with the most swivel-eyed of anomalies, and it's just a matter of trying to work out more nuanced ways of thinking about how they interact, especially as going back to panspermia. I think it's, at the moment, the best description of how life appeared on Earth is directed panspermia. So we did come from space, like we did. Mm-hmm. And there is something at subsequent levels of us interacting with spirits as stars that changes changes what happens on this planet, the population of which came from space. So I'm glad it's had the reception it did, because it's a beginning thing, and there's more to be discussed and explored about it. But it, for me, it was hopefully resetting the worldview dysfunction in having these conversations.
Absolutely, I think that's precisely what it does, and I really have to. You know, it seems like such an obvious fit to those of us who, you know, deal in all of this stuff, but you know, the way you put it together, I thought was just so concise and really started a conversation that hadn't really been there before. So I pushed the book on lots of people, let's put it that way. I really do think it started a really interesting conversation that has a lot of ways it can go and can grow.
My own little brick in the ziggurat of the dominant of witchcraft.
What are your thoughts on monuments on Mars and things like that?
I'm broadly into them. I think not all of them. A lot of it's, you know, crazy. The C-3PO head isn't on the moon.
Nazi helmet on Mars, right?
But you only need to find one. And there's about 50 of them that I think are like very compelling. And that's enough. Like, genuinely, that's enough. And it kind of comes back to the panspermia thing. Like, I think even in some sort of hypothetical court of law, I think you can say, look, that's evidence. You can't just say, no, it isn't. You have to tell me what it is. You have to tell me what that pyramid is, or you have to tell me what the Phobos monument that Buzz Aldrin mentioned on C-SPAN is. Explain how that gets how that's naturally occurring, because a guy who went into space just described it as artificial. Your move. And so in that sense, you only need one of them, and I think we've got about 50, and that's important. It's important because they appear to be very old, clearly artificial, and at least as far as the three of us are aware, there is nothing of there are no complex physical organisms living on Mars or Phobos or so on, at least as far as we're aware. So all of a sudden we have the beginnings of a timeline for our solar system that I think is useful and needs to be. These are the pieces of the kind of broader ETH discourse that I think need to be brought into the dominant of witchcraft, because these are very good. These aren't whistleblowers or any of that kind of problematic data that you get in ETH land. These are pictures and statements from an astronaut. And you know, in the case of Dr. Brandenburg stuff, like a pretty good case, as far as I can tell, for, weapon signature in the Martian atmosphere. And even without that one, you're left with the other 50 of them. So this is where, like, kind of yesterday's post, sometimes it's actual aliens. Sometimes it is. It may not be now, but it seems to be. And not only that, some of the things look recognizable. I don't mean sphinxes and pyramids. Even like even the monument on Phobos is artificial in a way that a human would recognize. And I think that says some. Mm-hmm. I think says something very important about other non-human persons that share the universe with us.
Now, the weapon signature, is there any chance that can be something else?
Well, I asked him that, and I've been running down the list, and the only thing I can find is someone who he then published a paper rebutting that it was something to do with plasma or whatever, but we're talking about the Xenon 129, which is apparently can be associated with some sort of plasma effect, which I asked him, but he's a plasma physicist. He's a plasma physicist who worked for, military industrial private companies. He says, this is my background is plasma physics. It's not that. And then he listed all these reasons that I'm like, over my head goes this level of science. But otherwise, if a plasma physicist says it's Xenon 129, and even I can kind of read through the holes in the rebuttal, there's something to it. And again, even if there isn't, there's still the monument and Phobos. But in a weird kind of way, you start to not only have a timeline, but you start to have a narrative. It's almost like they are, in this particular context, mutually supporting data sets. And this is quite a challenging and dodgy thing to do. And it's not good science if you can avoid it, to sort of stack circumstantial evidence together in a circular loop, which is, well, there's some very old and apparently very damaged monuments on Mars, and there's also a bomb signature in the atmosphere, and as a result, there's damaged things on Mars, mm-hmm. which could probably be caused by a bomb. And so you get caught in this loop. But nevertheless, bearing in mind that that is epistemologically shaky, it's an idea we have to discuss, being fully aware that it is epistemologically shaky to get that circular. But what else are we going to do until Elon gets us there to have a look?
Well, I find I've always been partial to the whole electric universe idea and Velikovsky's ideas of Venus colliding with Mars. And if you did have those thunderbolts, those massive ejections of plasma between Mars and Venus at some point in the past, I wonder if that could have caused that signature.
I specifically asked him, because I quite like parts of electric universe as well. And so I specifically asked him about that. And he came back and said, he's the same. He's like, I'm really partial. As a plasma physicist, as you might expect, I'm really partial to the electric universe hypothesis. And then this big, long, again, too science-y email for how it's not those things. Because those are one of the ones that he ran down, like, okay, which I think is quite diligent to kind of go, okay, well, is there anything naturally occurring, as far as we can tell, in the history of Mars that would have done this, and there isn't on Earth either. So let's look off planet. In the first place you look is, of course, the sun. And as a plasma physicist, he's reasonably good at that and ran through them. And so over a period of 5 years, he landed on, I think it has to be a bomb. And I agree. I thought that was what it was going to be. But I asked him, and he's like, I like electric universe and I'm aware of it. That's not what this is.
Interesting.
Yeah, me too. Like, it's the one that I try to, this is, I guess, best practice in general, but it's Dr. Brandenburg's research is the one I'm most interested in finding an alternative explanation for, because it positively defines important if true. and so, like, I ask people, like, if anyone's out there who's got something, and he's the same. Like, his email address is on his website. It's like, if you can find another better explanation for Xenon 129 in the Martian atmosphere, I will be the first person to read it. And I think that's quite healthy. I think that's actually one of the things that endears him to me, is he's still 20 years later on a quest to disprove it.
Yeah. And that's incredibly important in all this type of stuff. Science, as well as what people may consider pseudoscience.
Mm-hmm. Soraya, Gordon, if you don't mind this, you talk a lot about magic. We talk a lot about the theoretical underpinnings of magic, the history and things like that. But I think a lot of people would be interested, if this isn't too personal, and if it is, please say so. But because I think a lot of people have the idea that anyone who's a magician, you know, is just waking up and, you know, running to their altar and doing their thing, every day, all day, that sort of thing. And I think they have probably a skewed idea of what a practical magician does. So how much does actual practical working magic inform your day to day or your life? Like, what is the flow or the shape of actual magical working in your life?
Fair enough. In a broader sense, if you are kind of careening from one disaster to the other that requires sort of practical enchantment intervention on a daily basis, then you probably need to look at structurally how your life is running and where it can be optimized, because that's absolutely true. In the same way, if you shouldn't be taking antibiotics every day or whatever. Like, this is not a viable long-term solution. Mine is more or less daily, so I do have daily devotional stuff. Depending on, there are special guest stars in it, shall we call it that? there are some regular ones, but there are special guest stars. So broadly speaking, you will find people who regularly practice do something like that on a daily basis. I was actually pretty good for the first couple of months of the year doing daily meditation. I'll be honest, it's been about 10 days, such is life. But generally, those two form a kind of baseline, at least in terms of how magic is practically expressed today. Outside of that, I usually have, as I do now, long-running experiments, usually either grimoire or spirit-based. So I've got one that's a year long that's actually winding up. And in addition to that, there's sort of tactical, practical enchantment that I run a premium members group on RuneSoup, where every quarter there's a different kind of course on practical magic and a bunch of other stuff like the weekly video Q&As and so on. But the first one was on sigil magic. And one of the things that RuneSoup became known for was a sort of specific way of using sigils. And so the course takes people through that, but at a broad stroke level, at least once a month, depending on the astrological conditions and lunar days, if you get something that seems quite an exciting opportunity, there's usually at least once a month or so where there will be a practical shoaling. The shoal is the sort of collective noun I use for enchanting or empowering multiple sigils at once, all of which is described in either my book or the website. And so that happens on a sort of regular basis. And other than that, there tends to be short-term experiments going on as well. What's interesting about that is you have the sort of daily stuff. Interesting. I hope it's interesting. What's interesting about that is you have the daily stuff, and you have one long-running, and this one, which I can't talk about just yet, but the long-running one-year experiment that is winding up next month has kind of prevented, there's some sort of polar magnet situation going on with different spirit lists. So if you're working with a version of one, it's been kind of challenging for me to work with like a later version of the spirit list that's associated with this long running experiment, which is interesting in and of itself. It's interesting that suggests, again, either I'm completely crazy, very possible, or there is some external reality to whatever the spirit list describes. And as a result, I can't kind of get it to do two different things at the one time. So that's generally it. Like, it will depend. There's, as you know, because Michael, you've been on my show for tarot talking. That happens as well. Sometimes just when I'm bored, like usually you end up getting a life. Like, tarot is fun. So there will be at some stage during the month some form of divination, but not that much at the moment. I'm kind of aware of where things, if I need it, I'll use it. And that's about it. And then there's also a fortnightly, another kind of spirit practicing, which I also can't talk about because other people are involved, that's specifically to do with the dead and so on a regular basis with a group. So it depends who you ask. This is the kind of classic thing about magic. But inevitably, if you are taking it seriously, and by the way, I'm not a typical example of people who will admit to practicing practical enchantment because they do it quite a bit. That is absolutely not necessarily not necessarily what you need to do. I've kind of got my calendar full with this sort of stuff, and that's newish for this year. But yes, usually you will find that there is daily interaction with whatever kind of X-Men team the particular witch or whoever has, and that I think is the baseline. And on top of that, is it depends on your life.
That brings up something too. I mean, you talk a lot about working with the saints, you know, these kind of ancient superheroes, and also, you know, some of the spells in the grimoire section and a lot of the magic you talk about. I know it probably freaks out a lot of people because there are Christian references in it. You know, most people or you know, the common conception of magicians is that we're all working in a strictly, you know, pagan mythos. So it freaks out a lot of people, especially those that, you know, kind of came of age with Wicca and neo-paganism and things like that, to see these, you know, Christian elements and, you know, names of saints or the use of saints as, you know, devotional candles and all that sort of thing. So that was really fascinating to me because that was something I had sort of picked up. So seeing you referencing it well was a nice confirmation that I wasn't out of my mind, you know, in working with some of these guys and women that were part of my, you know, my Catholic upbringing. So I'd love if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And funnily enough, just in reference to the premium members group, there are a few people who are a bit squeamish, is a bit, is not fair enough, but have some concerns about the upcoming Grimoire course because it the method of interaction with these particular spirits is embedded within a Christian context. Funnily enough, the people I find who are most resistant to a Christian context are the ones that I would define as being far away from the experience of the sort of magical technology of Christianity, because it inevitably is someone who's grown up in some sort of Midwest happy clappy, probably CIA funded megachurch, and it's not Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's not. It doesn't have any of its foundational rituals. It doesn't have anything to do with the sort of church father metaphysics that informs things like baptism. And you can like or not. The point is, Christianity is a system of magic that emerged out of the classical world, Platonism and Neoplatonism. Mm-hmm. So it is pagan, literally, in that sense, and it is predicated on these rituals that are the stuff that was expressed in you know, the happy-clappy devotionalist churches. That's not Christianity. That's some kind of mutant demon virus. So I sort of tell people, like, okay, I to try and find where it is that they're resistant about. And it's usually that. And I'm like, okay, that's good. So the good news is you weren't raised Christian. what you need to do now is go and actually look at the underlying metaphysics. You don't have to, no one's being converted here, right? Mm-hmm. Go and look at the underlying metaphysics of it, because the practice of magic in a Western understanding is necessarily embedded in this kind of like high medieval Catholic animism, which itself is necessarily embedded, like, congratulations, you're back to paganism, is necessarily embedded in this classical world formulation of gods and spirits and the role of humans and so on. It that's actually it. And this idea of rejecting it is also false. Like, I gave an interview for an Italian witch group last year. And I made the case, which they didn't like, but it's true of Wicca as well. Wicca is, by definition, a form of Christian Protestantism, because it emerges out of a Christian culture. And crucially, and this is why it's Protestantism, it emerges out of a dissatisfaction with how the prevailing culture conceives of God. That's what Protestantism was. There's obviously politics behind its various permutations. Mm-hmm. But there is no such thing as getting back. It doesn't work. You can't, that's not how evolution works. That's not how animism works. So the idea that someone has rejected it is just bad history, and they're just not plugged into the Well, again, doesn't mean everyone has to be Christian, but it means people who are maybe necessarily resistant to this idea, because there are some fairly potent magics involved in how something becomes a saint and the role of a saint in the universe that is embedded within these rituals, which are embedded within these high pagan rituals that everyone's trying to get back to. So it inevitably is kind of like the return context. It is the return of how we think about our past and which parts belong to you. That's the other thing. The Catholics kind of left themselves open to it. The word Catholic means universal. So their spells are universalizing. And I have people who were sort of Anglican going, I'm interested in doing the saints stuff. I'm Anglican. And I'm like, well, where did that come from? And also, if you go and look at it from a Catholic perspective, you'll be back. Like, that's baked into their spells. So you can, that stuff is still available to you. In a way, it's a poorly formulated spell, but as a result, it is something that people who, if they resonate with it, they have access to it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the work of like Robert Connor and Morton Smith on the idea of Jesus as magician?
It's good. The short answer is it's good. The short answer is, if you, again, coming back to when we're talking about those three different sort of lines of magic through European history, the Solomonic necromantic one is, in many respects, it's almost like the defining enchantment of Christianity is exorcism. Right. Jesus did it. Mm-hmm. Everyone, like, his, you know, Paul did it. Everyone was kind of, one of the defining characteristics of their powers was the ability to exorcise demons out of people or out of livestock or whatever it happened to be. Mm-hmm. Now, the word conjurer means exorcist, and it meant exorcist until the 17th century. So conjuring demons and exorcising, and this is why there's a long clerical underground through European history of essentially priests with not very much to do dabbling in grimoires, because as sort of representatives of Jesus on earth by virtue of being priests, Jesus gave to his disciples and followers his power over demons. Yes. So to conjure and to adjure and to bind demons is actually a fundamentally Christian technique that was then combined with the sort of combined sort of Hebrew Egyptian magic of the classical world, and you put those three pieces together and you get it. So you kind of, this is the return of the context for people who say, oh, you know, I'm not Christian, or I don't, you go, well, that's fine, but the tech you're using is, and like, these are just different descriptions of it at different points in the timeline, but you kind of need to be aware of that. And again, I just want to be clear. I had this conversation with Jesse Hathaway Diaz, and he said the same thing, because we're talking about it. He says, I'm not trying to convert anyone to Catholicism, and I'm definitely not. But the context is required, and it's just a classic chaos magic thing. We're just not that devotionalist. So the fact that you can restore context without having to go and get baptized, right? And that's sort of where I think people need to think when it comes to Western expressions of magic.
You also talk about prayer, which is something that is not often found in, you know, conversations about magic. And I found that really interesting. I really enjoyed that chapter in Pieces of Eight.
Well, again, it comes back to the data, and in this case specifically, Dr. Elizabeth Targ's data, so Russell Targ's daughter. Mm-hmm. She's dead now, but she was did very good work on the impact of healing prayer on people who were, you know, late stage suffering with AIDS, even ones who didn't even know they were being prayed for, and there are noticeable effects. So again, there are data behind it. Now, if there are data behind it, I'm interested, and I'm going to go and find how this works. Well, not how it works, but I'm going to find a way to make it work for me. And and so prayer comes into that. It's also, there are some really, particularly if you're okay with this sort of, just describing that kind of high medieval Catholic animism, particularly if you, even if you just want to inhabit that world briefly, again, a very kind of chaos magic thing to do, there are some really fun and evocative and potent prayers that are available to anyone based on the kind of Catholic formulation, that just go and try them. And usually the people who have pushback on it have ended up tying themselves in theological knots that I'm not sure they should have in the first place, which is, again, it's sort of an expression of that false Christianity that they maybe grew up in. Public declarations of being married to Odin before all others. I'm like, well, why did you do that? Whoever said do that? Did he give you a helicopter? No one's going to get that out of me unless they show up with many sacks with dollar signs on it. And they're like, oh, no, it was just a, it was a wild weekend. And I'm like, you might be better served unpicking that a little. But that's a kind of a devotionalism that I think is, well, it is unbecoming in Chaos Magic. That's what sort of Pete Carroll would say. If people are kind of wired that way, go for it. I prefer the sort of the magpieing and the contexting that is available to anyone, really.
One of the things you talk about, you get into a little bit of a form of astrology in there, and like cycles of things and kind of going with the stream as opposed to against it. And it made me think a little bit of Robert Schock's research on Psi, where he showed that experiments done when solar activity was high had much higher results than when solar activity was low.
Yeah. I want to be careful going with the stream. There's a difference between knowing the stream is there and going with it. And I think that is sort of more the point, which is, are you trying to do some backburning of the woodland during a rainstorm? So going with the stream necessarily implies that you're kind of just going to follow along with what happens with the world, which isn't quite the same thing.
Right. Yeah, that's not what I meant at all.
Yeah. I do want to make sure, because that's definitely not it. But like being aware that it kind of trumps when it's Trump time or it steam trains when it's steam trains time is there's something very useful about cycle models. And I think it was in the newsletter a couple of weeks ago where I quoted Tyler Cohen, who in his latest book, which is, I find, its proximity to the stuff described in Chaos Protocols, which came out 2 years before it or 18 months before it, is really fun to me because he's like, a tenured a tenured economist. But he said the data suggests, like the last 20 years of data suggests that a cycle model is a better description of our experience, or certainly an economic experience, than a more sort of positivist progressive one. And I think that's true. And I think obviously he's not going to take it to the implications we are, which is, well, that suggests we should look again in a contextual way at the different cycle models that are available in magic and match them to economic ones and astronomical ones like Dr. Schock's, and go, okay, there's something about the rhythm of the universe that suggests it is useful to us to conceive of it in a cyclical or waveform way. And what do you know, isn't it interesting that the universe is by and large waveform until it isn't? So you're kind of stumbling to a very interesting, and I think it necessarily remains permanently incomplete, but you're stumbling towards a very interesting metaphysical model. And this is the 19th century mistake, was to look at cutting edge science and look at cutting edge esotericism and smash them together and go, ha ha, theosophy or whatever. we must permanently, I don't think that it doesn't work in the dominant of witchcraft, but what you can do is hold these ideas next to each other for a long time and go, isn't that interesting? And necessarily have it incomplete, but compelling. And again, funny enough, speaking of Hynek, towards the end of his life, apparently, he came to a sort of radio wave model of describing UFOs. So here we have another waveform metaphysic, for want of a better word, to layer into the other ones. And again, you kind of do that and you squint at them rather than plug them together. And you think there's something to this. And why I put the astrology in Pieces of Eight is Pete Carroll. And I understand why. In the mid-80s, you're still kind of dealing with the kind of Castaneda, Age of Aquarius astrological stuff. So he kind of repudiated all of astrology, going, well, this is nonsense. And the description of astrology in the 70s was nonsense, because it was some kind of energy beam from a planet in our solar system coming down that made you slightly more in love. Like, it's dumb. It's not correct. But a clock doesn't create the time. It can still tell it. So we have this sort of a story of a waveform or cycle model is baked into astrology rather than caused by it. And that's why I wanted to have that cycle discussion in Pieces of Eight, because it's something that needs to come back now that, as Tyler Cohen said, now that an analysis of the sort of wider data sets that have been available to us and also the computing power to crunch them that's happened in the last 20 years suggests a cycle model is a very useful thing for a magician to consider.
Okay.
I had a question. And I'm hoping this is something you can help me with, because I regularly get questions from people who are new to magic. They want to practice magic, and it's difficult for me because, my instinct is to say, well, start by reading history. Because my education in magic goes back to when I was a kid. And then I got caught up in the whole Golden Dawn thing for a lot of years. And then I kind of, shoved that to the curb where it needed to be, before picking up, other traditions, chaos magic, and then in the 90s and evolving from that. But so it's hard for me to say, like, where, okay, do they go in from, is it easier to get for someone to make their way through a folk magic perspective, like hoodoo or something like that, which is very, sort of simple, easy to begin without a lot of theory. I kind of push them in the direction of your books. I think there's, but without knowing the history of magic, what would you say would be a good entryway for someone who's saying, I'm fascinated by this. I want to start experiencing it. I want to start practicing it on some level, without wandering into the bookstore and grabbing, Scott Cunningham's book off the shelf or something like that. Like, what would be the way you would sort of guide someone into beginning a practice in this time where there's just so much available?
It's hard. Well, it is, because no one listens. So I kind of had to think about this for Chaos Protocols in particular, because I get that fairly often as well. Mm-hmm. And no one listens. No one's ever listened.
You mean I have to read a book?
Like, if you try to tell people, I certainly didn't. No one ever did. A year's worth of elemental balancing and what have you. Like, no one ever does it. It's like, wait, so there's a book of demons over there and I can go and get it and get high with my friends. And well, I'm going to do that rather than your kind of elemental thing, because that sounds quite boring. And so no one's ever listened. That's literally what Crowley did with the Goetia, right? Mm-hmm. So I did something potentially irresponsible, but I think in retrospect, correct with Chaos Protocols, which is step one is to become invincible. And I don't care how you do it. So you have to have that extreme experience. And, mm-hmm. and I truly don't care how you do it. I truly mm-hmm. don't care if you terrify yourself with an alien abduction or any of that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, but you, and until you've done that, the books are irrelevant. Like, mm-hmm. Because you're just going to ask me another question. That's the other thing that I'm like, you're going to ask me another question if I give you a book. I say, go and read this book. And then they'll come back and go, well, I have some questions about this book. And I'm like, well, I know where this is going, and I'm a little bit busy. So here's my other suggestion. It's go and have an extreme paranormal event happen to you, however you want it. Yeah. Shaman in South America, Ouija board in abandoned mental hospital, mm-hmm. all that kind. Like, you open up Netflix, look at American Horror Story, and pick one. It would be lovely if you had a transformative and benign experience where your grandfather physically manifested unbidden in the living room in shining light and told you that everything's fine and mm-hmm. he's fine and what have you. But it doesn't have to be that. And that's usually when you kind of separate the I'm interested in practicing magic from I'm interested in people on the internet thinking I'm a magician. Because the difference is like, oh, I have an abandoned mental hospital near me. I will thank you very much, sir. I will go and do that. I'm like, oh, you can write me back. The other ones, they're not cooked yet. And also it's not a universal, this is the definition of a niche experience of the world. So, and yes, it has high interest, but it has low participation.
Right.
And you have to discern the difference. And for me, it's been that. So I tell people that.
I think the ones that it really sticks with are the ones that have already had that sort of initiatory experience anyway. And that's what's leading them to, you know, say, maybe I want to try and see if I can, you know, control or channel some of this to make sense of what I have already experienced.
Well, then if they're interested in a subset, so if they're interested in, I would like to channel, or I'm quite interested, and usually they'll tell you, like, I'm interested in going further with ancestor stuff, or I'd like to learn, you know, automatic writing or whatever it happens to be. You can kind of get them at a subset level and go from there. But the other thing, you go around the houses with that stuff. Like, I mean, after 20-something years, I look at the stuff that I have done and I have read. And the many times as a teenager, I thought I'd had it all worked out. And like, after that first experience, go and do anything, go and do something, go and do whatever. and if it works, and there's just no other way. It's like the other important things in life, like sexuality or whatever, like, it's going to be specific to you, and you're only going to find it by doing the exploring. And the good news is there are other, like, come back to me and share your stories of what happened. That might be better. And that's better for everyone.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay. I guess the last thing I wanted to make sure I brought up in this conversation, you have a chapter on there about health and the way that the West kind of deals with health at this point and how, well, bad it is.
Yeah, I think... this is almost another route into Chapel Perilous that we were just talking about. This is almost another route into Michael's hypothetical Fortean conference. Because the health is something that affects us all. Like, that, it sounds like a dumb political thing to say, but it actually is. Health and nutrition and so on, it's unavoidable. And as a result, it's been caught up in any number of the 20th century hijacks, from dysfunctional materialism to the impact of corporations on state policy to the detriment of, you know, the deaths of actually millions of people and so on. And the desecration of the environment and all this kind of stuff. So you kind of can't not. And also there's something quite, something that is an echo of the traditional witch's role as poisoner and herbalist and someone willing to do radical things that makes you realize you can never, certainly not when it comes to your own health and nutrition, listen to official sources, because they have repeatedly proven to be wrong. But also in front of us are all these tools that, much like magic, that you can use. So the guy who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine last year, Japanese doctor, he discovered autophagy. Well, he discovered that you can trigger extreme autophagy with essentially fasting, and completely fasting for 7 days. So we're looking at a world where if you fast for 7 days a year, you won't get cancer, because autophagy is the process of the body completely replacing all the broken down and damaged cells and re-extending telomere and so on. And you just don't eat for 7 days. That combined with the role of entheogens and the sort of access to and lack of access to foods of different nutritional qualities and the opportunity to grow your own and be part of community supported agriculture. And so is essential, because not only is the sort of Western food system corrupt and broken and not built for you, neither is the healthcare system, which at least for Americans is, who knew it could get any worse? But apparently it can. And there's no way that doesn't get better. I just, for that kind of stuff, single payer healthcare will one day, and actually quite soon, come to the US. So you have to not die in the next 4 or 5 years. It's basically, mm-hmm. it's shit advice. Sorry to swear again, but you have to not die. Mm-hmm. And even when single payer healthcare comes, I don't have a very high opinion of a lot of what will come out of it, just because you end up treating cancer with treatments that cause more cancer rather than fasting and THC and, mm-hmm. and so on. So those are the kind of things that have always been the role of the witch is to mm-hmm. know yeah. these things. And that's why it had to go in the book, because it's so essential.
Mm-hmm. There's, you also talk about ritual being an important part of achieving health, psychological health. And the idea of fasting, I mean, fasting has always been a spiritual technology too. So you really are working with the whole mind body thing. And the idea of placebo, there's such a dismissive, less so now that the more research is being done of it, but a very dismissive, attitude toward placebo, especially when it comes to alternative medicine. Whereas I think, if that acupuncturist even if it were just ritual that of the needles being inserted into your body in a calming environment, talking to you, it works. So it's working. So more and more people shift to alternative methodologies for taking care of their health, I think that's leading to a lot of, the whole idea of the mind, body, spirit, as corny as that's brandished about, but very much the truth of it, that as we're treating our body physically by fasting, we're also gaining spiritual benefits from that, and so forth.
I would say in the hypothetical Fortean conference, mm-hmm. At least a third of the sessions would have to be on a new medicine, mm-hmm. because whilst, and I'm, modern, and my father's a doctor, so modern medicine has a highly dysfunctional and corrupt worldview. It's a corporate materialism designed to enrich big pharma, essentially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That said, alternate medicine has some really unsophisticated worldviews to do with energy models and so on as well. So yeah. it is an area of the dominant of witchcraft that requires everyone's attention and everyone's discussion and everyone's research, because we can't leave it in this idiotic binary mm-hmm. of corporate materialism or some kind of fruity 70s energy model. Mm-hmm. It's too important. It's the only thing you can't get away from. Mm-hmm. It will kill you. Whatever it is, it kills you. So, that's the discussion we need to have.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think fasting has such health benefits?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I actually think a lot of it is to do with what Michael was just saying about why we find it in spiritual traditions, but not just spiritual traditions. Pythagoras used to make his students fast before exams for a week and then during them. And they would do this because, and so it's 2 weeks without food, and none of the starvation stuff happens. That's all wrong. The body doesn't do that at all. But you get smarter. The body cleans itself of the decayed cells. Your telomeres expand and sort of reform. You get a hormonal reset. So the growth hormones that cause cancer stop. You drop your insulin, which is the fat storage chemical that's also associated in high levels with things like depression and then eventually diabetes and all kinds of stuff. So for stopping eating resets a human back to a remarkable form. So I don't know why that is. That appears to be how we've built. You could say that we're sort of biohacking the evolutionary advantage that is humans can live for extended periods of time without food, or otherwise we wouldn't have evolved. That may well be part of it. But I tell you what, if you do a 4 day and up fast, so I did one the other week, I went 4 days. I had this distinct impression that it felt, you remember the Stargate movie, right? Not the, yes. not the space series. Mm-hmm. And how they had these sort of resurrection chambers for the sort of space yeah. Egyptian girls. That's what it feels like. After you get up, the end of day two is a bit uncomfortable, but then after that, you just, there's a weird sense of background joy. you sleep better, and you just feel like you're being rebuilt in some kind of weird Egyptian ritual. So I don't know why that is, to answer your question. I have no idea, but it appears to be a thing that we've always used up until recently, and it's probably essential.
Hmm. All right. Well, people can find you where, Gordon?
RuneSoup.com, obviously the best place. There's also RuneSoup's on Facebook page, has a Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter. But yeah, RuneSoup.com is where they can find out about the books and the blog and the podcast and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. And any last questions, Mike, before we let Gordon go?
No, we covered a lot. It was really a lot of fun. So thanks, Gordon.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that. I'm sure we'll have Gordon back sometime very soon. So, also, we are still collecting personal stories, and I know I've talked to a bunch of you about them, and I'm hopefully going to have some personal story shows up very soon. My life has been kind of a wreck for most of 2017, and it's left me with very little time to do things that I want to do, like those personal story shows. They'll probably be, I'll probably just do a show per story, and it'll just go up as a podcast and YouTube. But hopefully very soon I will be contacting people and getting some stories. I know some of them I've been sitting on for quite a while. And I've had a lot of people contacting me. And if you want to contact me about a personal story you've had, you can do so at stories@wheredidtheroadgo.com. Also, if you're a musician and you want your song to be in the outro music for this show, you can contact me at contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com. And I'm pretty open to any musical style, as long as it's independent, it's yours, you know, and you can give me the rights to use it. I will more than likely use it at the end of the show at some point. And tonight we're going to end with some Eliza Rickman, and this is Pretty Little Head. See you next time.
wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mind, dirty mouth, pretty little head. But where's your mother? Fall down dead. Dirty mind, dirty mouth, pretty little head. Wish you were here. Wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mind, dirty mouth.